Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, continuing with the special series, Slavery, Past and Present, the Post-Civil War Continuation of Slavery in the United States. We have two panelists today. Our first is Professor James Brewer Stewart. He is Professor Emeritus of History in the areas of race, politics, social movements, and labor systems. He's written dozens of books and is highly regarded as a national expert on the American abolitionist movement. In 2011, he founded the nonprofit organization Historians Against Slavery, which brings together scholars to investigate the historical context behind modern-day slavery in order to better inform social activism and civil efforts to eradicate the new forms of servant indenture that is increasing in the United States. The organization hosts annual conferences for the public that feature experts in the field of modern-day slavery. His website is historiansagainstslavery.org. He will be joined in the second part of our program by Stephen Watt. Stephen Watt is the senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union and its human rights program, specializing in civil and human rights litigation, which includes U.S. rendition, detention, interrogation programs, human trafficking and forced labor, juvenile justice, and women's immigrants and juvenile justice. Earlier, while working for the Center for Constitutional Rights as a human rights fellow, and among the cases he's worked on are the Rasul versus George Bush and two cases against Attorney General John Ashcroft. Stephen has also done substantial work overseas as a public defender for the government of the Solomon Islands, managing refugee camps in Tanzania, and directing emergency programs for displaced persons in Liberia. Originally from Scotland, Stephen has a law degree from the University of Aberdeen, a degree in legal practice from the University of Edinburgh, and an LLM in international human rights from the University of Notre Dame. His website is his homepage at uaclu.org, bio Stephen M. Watt. I'd like to welcome both of you to our program.
Thank you. This is Jim Stewart speaking.
And Jim, we're going to begin with Professor James Brewer Stewart. I recently read Karen Armstrong's book, Fields of Blood, Religion and History of Violence, which traces religion from its Neolithic period to the present and looks at how it has contributed to violence while also giving birth to anti-violent movements as well. But one observation I made is that enslaving people, whether from conquered enemy villages or tribes, kingdoms, nations, or civilizations, has been a part of the human condition and its history for thousands of years. Therefore, simply because we wish to regard ourselves as modern and enlightened and progressive does not preclude that we are any less violent than our ancestors, and that if the conditions permit and there's a reason to benefit from it, slavery is an option. And indeed, slavery remains with us, not simply in sweat factory conditions in the South, in Southeast Asia, or in Brazil or Bolivia, but even in the most developed nations, including the United States. Nevertheless, every child attending public school will graduate believing that slavery was abolished by Lincoln after the Civil War. And yes, there are also taught that it wasn't until the latter half of the 20th century that African Americans, whose ancestors were once slaves, attained civil and human rights, and this was a long and uphill struggle. But how true is this story we are told about the abolition of slavery? And I believe that the stories we hold or embrace will continue to shape our present and future understanding about ourselves and our culture and our politics, and will frame the ways to deal with injustices. So before I ask you to correct the official history of the abolition of slavery and show how it continued as a powerful economic factor for the United States to become a global power and the rise of the new abolitionist movement today, please explain why it is so important for people today to fully understand the history of slavery and why it is so critical to revise the older myths and textbooks that were taught to us decades ago, and Do we need to redefine the word slavery in order to tackle the human rights conditions of millions of people today? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Why, thank you. That's a very, very broad platform of questions to ask me, and I'm purposely not taking notes because there's no way in the world to peel this onion in any recipe way. Let me just start by making sure that everybody does understand that your point about slavery being a perpetual part of the human condition is entirely true. It's real easy for us to think about great big moments of emancipation, particularly in the United States when the Civil War that created the emancipation of 4 million people cost the lives of now close to 485,000 people in a population then of only 30 million people. Imagine how citizens of the United States today would respond to mortality figures like that. The cost in treasure and blood to expropriate what was at the time the second largest capital asset in the U.S. economy by force. That's what Ulysses S. Grant and the other guys did. Creates a trauma and a memory and a scar and a moment of tremendous opportunity for African-American people that's very hard to deny. And the idea of turning all that into a triumphal story, and you can see that triumphal story developed in movies like Glory, if you're familiar with that film, that one way or another, we're on a progressive and forward-thinking escalator from something terrible to a much better world. And couple what I've just said with the idea that this political culture could and did elect and re-elect a black president. And one can even find, as I'm sure you understand, that people are talking about a post-racial America. The problem with all that is that those memories are strong, those memories are have a tremendous hold on our imagination, and in one lobe of your brain, they're true. The idea that 4 million people are transformed partly by their own agency, partly by the agency of the U.S. Army, into people who by 1867 have full stature of citizenship under U.S. constitutional law is an amazing feat for any society to put itself through. The idea, one way or another, though, that that's a launching pad for a progressively more cheering narrative is very, very difficult to draw, but it's hard to get people to stop thinking that way. Because the fact of the matter is, to put it in a very small quote from my favorite white abolitionist, the guy whose biography I've written, Wendell Phillips, he said that when the 13th Amendment was passed, his observation was, we've abolished the slave, but the master remains. And what he was saying by that is that the same people who had the habit of being slaveholders were going to run the South in the long run, unless the whole place was completely made over, which of course it never was. And what survived out of slavery, and there's been a lot of work done on this, is a new form of what Doug Blackman, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Slavery by Another Name, called Slavery by Another Name. And the kind of slavery that he's talking about is chain gangs, a prison industrial complex that ferries people all over the South in cages, manacled, shackled, to do the work for private contractors, to do the work for the state, to provide employment for people who supervise them, to keep the tax base low, and to do many of the same things that people charge today's in prison industrial complex of doing. And the fact of the matter is that this particular form of enslavement went on from the 1880s all the way through 1945, was finally abolished, but at the same time, other forms of that kind of exploitation come along to take their place. You get to the Rockefeller drug laws, you get to all the different more familiar things that show up in a book by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow, which is a searching critique of today's prison system. And suddenly you have a very different narrative than the one that goes from the Emancipation Amendments to the Civil Rights Movement to Martin Luther King to Barack Obama. And it's this contested narrative. It's this narrative that the dominant culture does not want to think about, let alone embrace, that to me explains so much of what others are remarking upon so surprisingly as black rage. Because that counter-narrative that I just went over, plus a lot of other things that go along with it, having to do with state violence, having to do with Ku Klux Klan, having to do with so many different things that we can put into the mix, creates a entirely different understanding of American history, which is a series of whiplashes and backlashes not a straight line narrative from bad to good. So in order to be able to think about slavery in the United States today, yes, you do have to be able to define slavery differently. It's not the same thing as having a constitution before the Civil War that guaranteed property rights for people to own each other, that set up every instrument of capitalism in order to be able to protect that property, including the U.S. Constitution, and where slave codes made slavery legal and very easy and simple to define. Once slavery is abolished, it becomes a term without a legal standing, if you understand what I'm saying. A literary critic would call it a floating signifier. It can come to mean many things, and it's been expanded in the vocabulary of some people to such a heightened rhetorical degree that you can be enslaved by your television set, you can be enslaved by tobacco, you understand what I'm talking about, moving from social reality to metaphors, and from being concerned about other people to a kind of narcissism about your own dependency on various things. But the fact of the matter is that, yes, the institution's always been with us. If we look at it from the long point of view from way, way back when to right up until today, there is no free space where freedom is uncontested by slavery. And so we shouldn't be surprised that it's in our society now, but it is very hard for particularly Americans who view their history in the way that you outlined to be able to make this leap into the counter-contested narrative that goes along with it, the yes, but. Is that enough of an answer to get us started?
It is. I appreciate that. Please summarize for us why the American history of the end of slavery in the 19th century is erroneous, as stated by many textbooks and teachers, and in what ways did slavery continue to be practiced well into the 20th century, even after the end of the Second World War?
Well, I've explained a little bit of that when I started talking about chain gangs and slavery by another name. I would really suggest that people go back and pull a book out by Douglas Blackman, which deservedly won the Pulitzer Prize, called Slavery by Another Name. The reason this is possible, it was possible to continue slavery while slavery was being abolished, has its origins actually in the wording of the 13th Amendment, the amendment that emancipated 4 million people. The wording of that amendment has contained with it an exception for criminals, for people who have been indicted and convicted and incarcerated under law. The idea is that the Emancipation Proclamation is not designed to abolish the prison system or penology or the idea of being able to hold people in conditions where their labor and their bodies are controlled by others totally in the same way that slavery would be, because they've been convicted of crimes and therefore are outside the pale of citizenship. That makes all kinds of sense at the time, but that's also what Wendell Phillips had in mind when he said, we have abolished the slave, the master remains. It's seen in retrospect as, first of all, a logical thing for legislators to do, but also at the same time as a loophole for people who would like to create slavery by another name to be able to do exactly that. You should think, for example, about the history of Angola prison in Louisiana. Angola, strange name for a prison, isn't it? Why would you name your prison after a country in West Africa? Well, the reason why is because prior to being Angola Prison in Louisiana, Angola was a plantation named after the source of the supply of its labor force. It was held by slaveholders. It was passed down from one generation to the next, was turned over to the state during Reconstruction, turned into a prison, which at the same time produced profits for the family that had been the slaveholders beforehand. You can see just in that vignette a easy transition from one form of slavery to another, slavery by another name. Great continuity in the interests involved, great continuity in the victims involved. And while at the same time, in Louisiana particularly, because the history of Reconstruction in Louisiana is so spectacular, African-American politicians are doing incredible things in their state legislature. All kinds of different things are going on that suggest that black agency is terribly important post-emancipation, and in certain ways very, very successful in Louisiana. But at the same time, here's this hidden history that begins with the exception clause in the 13th Amendment, turns a prison into a plantation into a prison, and that plantation lives on to the present day. So that's the kind of things that, those are the kinds of facts that we are beginning to know. There's a brand new book by a wonderful historian who teaches at University of, I hope it's right, Central Florida, whose name is Talifia LaFleur, who's done a whole big, deep investigation of African-American women caught up in precisely this kind of prison situation in Georgia. We see this kind of scholarship going on and then connecting it more and more to the kinds of dynamics that take you more to the prison industrial complex that we have today. So if you begin to remember that reconstructions are never permanent, emancipations never last, forms of racial and labor control replace one another, many of the old characters who are the oppressors of one system have a tendency to persist into the next, then you begin to understand that there is a deep, deep kind of awful continuity lying underneath the more hopeful history of emancipation, African-American agency, civil rights, political rights, so forth and so on. I hope that that's a response to your question. I wanted to try and get to something very specific, Angola, to show how it works.
And you did. When we think of slavery in the United States, we tend to only thinking of the black experience and the slave trade from Africa. However, U.S. slavery extends well beyond that, including the Chinese coming to work on the railroads, immigrants from Europe, and particularly the Irish and Eastern European nations, and other ethnic and national groups. What can you say about how these immigrants found themselves in slave-like conditions when they settled in the United States?
Well, I think the best way to start doing this is to jettison the word slavery and make it plural. Let's talk about slaveries instead of slavery. Let's talk about the history of slaveries within the United States. And I think that that begins to open up the field so that you can get into the kinds of topics that have been well researched by lots of other people who are working in this field. The depth of understanding, first of all, of Indian slavery, the enslavement of indigenous Americans, which is something that begins in the 17th and 18th century and finds Native American people from the Mississippi Valley ending up in Bermuda and Jamaica. The enslavement of African Americans by Cherokees and Creeks. That's another story that's very important, very undertold, and which has a great deal to do with all of the discussions about blood quantum and who's a tribal member in Oklahoma right to this very day. There's a great amount of work that's being done right now on the history of Central American labor into the American far west and southwest, that suggests that bracero programs, what were when immigrants were being either invited or forced or brought in by contract laborers, the same way that the Chinese were, almost simultaneously, are putting together new forms of slavery by another name. Yeah, I think that the idea of making sure to create a whole variety of narratives about slaveries is terribly important, but at the same time, there has to be a tremendous priority put on the central importance, it seems to me, of the African-American experience in order to be able to turn around the minds of reflexive Americans who simply want to tell a triumph story. Because it's that central central African-American narrative that's in their heads all the time by saying, we used to have slavery, we were bad. Now we don't have slavery, we were good. We used to have segregation, we were bad. Now we have a post-racial society, and we're good. African-Americans, and I know this from an awful lot of conversation and an awful lot of thinking about it on my own, listen to the global debate about slavery today and watch their entire narrative being completely ignored. If you start looking at the big NGOs that want to talk about slavery in the United States or in China or in Thailand or anyplace else, the idea of pitching to Americans to contribute money, to become all involved, to get involved in church groups and so forth and so on, is from the standpoint of African Americans, taking away the central theme in their history, which is just as important to them as any other tremendous tragedy is in the history of any ethnic group or nationality. And there's a great deal of resistance and a great deal of hostility to the idea of having your history stolen by an anti-slavery movement. Is that enough?
Well, almost. I want to segue because you raised the issue that most people do not fully appreciate about the early abolitionists such as Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs, Greenleaf Whittier, Lydia and David Child, and others were truly up against. And it was far more than simply cotton, tobacco, and agricultural plantations and large estates holding 4 million slaves. there was an entire economic system that was a dominant paradigm in place that went well beyond individual slaveholders.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe in detail what the slave system was that the abolitionists were trying to bring down?
Yeah, actually, now you've finally gotten into my comfort zone about all the things that I've been working on most of my life. There's a wonderful book that can start you off on this, which is, I'm 75 years old, and occasionally names slip past me. I'm trying very hard not to do that. By a Cornell historian, who is actually the keynote speaker for our Historians Against Slavery conference at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati next month, and I'm blowing his name all over the place. It's just awful. Who has written a huge book on the economic system of enslavement in the antebellum world, which makes it very clear that everybody is tied into slavery through insurance companies, through northern manufacturing, through the way that currency policy works, through the way that titles are transferred, to the way that endowments are set up. I'm battling very hard to get the name back in my head as I make the list longer and longer, but you get the idea. The name will come to me soon enough. The idea that one way or another the American economy is based tremendously on slavery is clearly to see it as a national system, not as a sectional practice. Point number one. Second of all, to cite another book of somebody whose name I'm having a hard time remembering, it's called Ebony and Ivory. It's a book about the impact of slavery on the intellectual and investment culture of colleges and universities in the United States. Greg Wilder is the name of this author, and he teaches at MIT. And he shows you that places like Harvard, Columbia, Dartmouth, small colleges like Williams and Amherst are places which are tremendous bastions intellectually and in terms of investment of pro-slavery things. Now, a big institution like Brown over the past decade or so has really tried to come to grips with this history. But if you take all the financial stuff that I've just explained, put it together with the dominant intellectual trends of the era, which all go in the direction of sorting people out into superior and inferior races, and you begin to see that slavery has an incredible stranglehold on everything, and then finally end up with the fact that the U.S. Constitution is a blatantly pro-slavery document protecting that property everywhere. And in order to prove that that's true, all you have to do is think of the amendments that had to be added to it in order to make it not that way, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And the abolitionists are up against a profoundly powerful system, which is supported more profoundly still by a extremely racially tyrannous kind of cultural oppression of African-American people everywhere. So the idea that you actually have abolitionists who stand up against this kind of stuff is, although abolitionists have their flaws as well, a provocation to people like me, who've written about these movements for most of my adult life, asking the question, what should we as historians who know the kinds of things that I've just been mentioning be doing now in the face of modern slavery? And the answer is, I hope, doing the kind of work that I and my colleagues are doing in Historians Against Slavery, and that's the reason I'm talking to you.
Well, one of your criticisms of the human rights movement, or what you call the new abolitionists regarding the social status of African Americans and other minorities, is that they have failed to fully understand what slavery truly is. And its historical impact upon the collective psyche of African Americans and the context for why it continues. Today we have the Black Lives Matter movement, which is correct in addressing the issues of mass incarceration, our private prison system, predatory lending on poor black communities, and the militarization police force, and rampant unemployment. Then explain, what is the failing to recognize?
There's just a huge racial blind spot among people who are leading these public appeals to fight slavery in your community and all over the globe. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I've sat down with basically the directors of several large NGOs that really do hog the spotlight and get an awful lot of money, suggesting very strongly that one way or another, when you say slavery in front of African Americans, you're talking about something that, when you don't include them, you are clearly discriminating against them. and that the African-American story should be the central touchstone out of which Americans begin to understand slavery in its all of its complexity and all of its varieties, because, and this is something that I've argued over and over again, the kinds of slaveries that happened without a name after emancipation, particularly incarceration, particularly debt bondage, particularly labor sequestration, all those kinds of things, are precisely the forms of slavery, while African Americans experienced them post-emancipation, they're the kinds of slavery that many groups of people are now having to endure. In other words, the history of African Americans post-emancipation with slavery is the history of slavery. And at the same time, there is no interest, almost no interest at all, out of the big NGOs to be able to address that kind of question at all. And I'm furious about it. So, and when you see the way that they traffic in the images of the abolitionist movement, the historical abolitionist movement put together, it's all on the idea of one way or another getting potential sympathizers to one way or another vicariously reprise the suffering of African Americans. The original abolitionist movement was full of woodcuts of slaves being hung up by their wrists and half naked and being lashed by masters, being sexually assaulted, being chased by bloodhounds, all that sort of thing. You can see all of those really sort of, I don't know what exactly to call them, pornography of pain kinds of images, where African American images are basically exploited in order to make a movement popular with whites. Those kinds of images, instead of learning from the fact that abolitionists trafficked in these kinds of things, white abolitionists did, and people like Frederick Douglass basically objected to it, the new abolitionist movement traffics in those images and updates them to 21st century forms and does it again. I think one of the most important things that academics who want to be socially responsible can do if they want to work in this field is to really level serious critiques of what passes as today's new abolitionist movement. Because there's a lot in it that's racist. There's a lot in it that's homophobic. There's a lot of it that says, we're against slavery and human trafficking, so let's build a wall against Mexico. A lot of it is masquerading as anti-slavery, and what it is nativism. And there's a lot of there's a lot of Orientalism in it, and there's a lot of anti-Muslim feeling in it. And the whole idea that one way or another, the Middle East is a place that's populated by pashas and brothels and all that kind of stuff is part of what the anti-slavery appeal is in certain communities. I'm sorry to go on this way, and I'm doing it kind of bitterly and at great length, but if you drop the African-American story out of the whole story of slavery, you get to do that kind of stuff.
Okay, then one more question for you, please, at this time. Later in this series, we will be investigating more closely in detail modern forms of slavery, including our private prison systems and debt indenture and our justice system and the sex trade. However, is it not true that most nations that have sought global power and influence in order to reach a certain level of supremacy over other nations or parts of the world succumbed to violent means that included enslaving others? And today, as the world's leading military and economic power, is it that surprising that the U.S. would also find ways to bend domestic and international laws to subjugate others into living and working conditions that can only be thought of as a modern labor bondage?
Okay. Yeah. No, I track everything you say, and I'm nodding my head in agreement with everything that you've just postulated. And this, to me, gets to why the focus on slavery is so terribly important, both as a rhetorical strategy and as a legal strategy. And I know you're going to be having somebody who's a lot better lawyer than I am coming on to talk about all this, so I'm hoping I'm setting up a little bit for him while I'm wrapping up here. The fact of the matter is that you think about slavery in one sense as this unanchored thing. It's no longer got a definition in property law the way it used to, so that you could hold up a slave code and say this is what slavery is. Instead, we have a bunch of general statements that have been put together by international bodies since 1926 with a series of statements that came out of the League of Nations, and they've been updated ever since. But it's a floating signifier. It's a term that is susceptible to many different definitions. The reason to talk about slavery is to open this larger discussion of the immiseration of labor that you were just talking about. If we do one more sort of highly theoretical, post-structural, post-Marxist critique of global capitalism, and do it all in the same kind of high academic style that so many people are given to doing it, there's no way in the world to communicate with ordinary people and to get people thinking about anything. We've been through that. And so that the idea of using a term that really does resonate, slavery, as a way to be able to open up questions exactly like the ones that you just posed, it seems to me, is the one promising way to intervene in this global neoliberal way of sinking all boats by raising all boats at the same time, so that there is an actual discourse around a problem that we can actually begin to put our hands on. At the same time, it seems really important to have another lobe of your brain saying you have to be able to prosecute people. You have to be able to take people to court. You have to be able to put people in jail. You have to be able to build around a set of reliable laws, the most important thing in the world, which is prevention, so that this doesn't happen, and what we would have to call reconstitution or reconstruction or whatever it is, taking people who've been through these horrific, terrible things, and providing the kind of redress that's necessary to try and put human lives back together again. Slavery always has a question of how do you stop it from starting, and how do you keep people who have been enslaved in civil society in such a way that you discharge the debt that you owe them. So it seems to me that using the term slavery as a interrogating device for these bigger issues that you raised in your last question, while at the same time trying to build a set of sensibilities about how to be able to prevent, to prosecute, and to reconstitute what the post-emancipation experience is one sensible way to try and dig in to what we have in front of us. That's the best I can do.
And you've done it very well. Please hold on, Professor James Brewer Stewart, Professor Emeritus of History, and he is our first panelist, but our second panelist is now standing by in New York City, Stephen Watt. He is the senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union and their human rights program, specializing in civil human rights litigation. And Stephen, nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. It's nice to meet you.
Stephen, labor trafficking facilitated by U.S. government overseas, contracting processes, to me, that's a form of slavery. Labor trafficking by U.S.-based diplomats in the State Department, facilitated by current visa routes and rules. Labor trafficking by the current U.S. guest worker visa programs. And finally, the living and wage conditions of the victims in these programs, analogous to modern slavery. So those are the areas I'm going to be asking you about. And we've known for many years that certain nations bring immigrant workers to their nations and then force them to labor indentured and become modern slave labor. I recall a report about Dubai when it was in its construction boom period and the slave labor camps filled with Filipinos, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Ugandans, and others living in horrible conditions and working endless hours building up Dubai into a metropolitan mecca. And many countries continue to use slave labor, including children, to manufacture products that we buy daily in the United States. But few people realize that U.S. corporations are also engaging in labor trafficking workers from poor nations overseas, however, through a more elaborate scheme, which on the surface would seem to indicate they are innocent. And yet these companies are private contractors in the military-industrial complex, servicing U.S. government and Defense Department, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. So first, before you explain how the scheme works, briefly summarize the United States' national and international anti-human trafficking laws, and then outline for us how the United States corporations and U.S. government contracts illicit foreign workers from poor countries, and when workers arrive and are employed, what are some of the more egregious conditions they find themselves in? The form is yours.
Thanks, Gary. So let me start first with the framework, the anti-trafficking framework. To be honest, the United States has some very good anti-trafficking legislation, and trafficking being a modern form of slavery. They have the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. They have criminal laws, and they have also civil penalties for victims of trafficking. So they're ahead of the game in terms of providing a legal framework. The problem, however, Gary, is enforcement of those laws. And part of that comes from a lack of an ability to identify victims of trafficking. Those have been enslaved through various schemes that operate both here in the United States and overseas, and are operated by US-based companies. So to get to the second part of your question, you know, how do these schemes operate? Let me speak about a report that I was involved in with the Yale Law School. We documented the issue of trafficking on overseas government contracts. But I think it'd be for your listeners first to just concretize what the problem is. Let me give you a concrete example of one of the victims of trafficking that we interviewed in the course of our reporting. So we met with a young man, Ramesh. He's a college graduate from India, and based in India, and he had borrowed a sum of $5,000, which was a relatively large sum for him. And he borrowed that sum from a local loan shark at an exorbitant rate of interest. It was something like 30%. And he borrowed that to pay a recruiting agent for the opportunity to work in, he believed, to work in Kuwait as a shopkeeper. That's what he was told. And that he was also told that the wage he would earn would be $800 a month, which was significant, and he believed that that would help to pay off the loan and then also meet the needs, his own needs and those of his family. He was providing for his family. And he wanted to provide a better life for them, and he wasn't going to be able to do that, he believed, in India. So he got involved in this recruitment scheme, believing he's going to go to a well-paid job in Kuwait. But instead of that, Ramesh, he was trafficked to a U.S. military base in Iraq. And there he was compelled to work as a janitor for $150 per month. And that just wasn't even enough to pay off the exorbitant rate of interest in his loan. And the loan sharks back home started to pressure his family into his making payments. So he was stuck in Iraq on a military base doing menial work, earning $150 a month in order to pay back the loan. He was enslaved on a U.S. military base in Iraq. And where's the U.S. connection here? Not only in the U.S. military base, but his ultimate recruiter, the government contracting process is such that the government puts out tenders for companies to recruit staff for construction, for janitorial services, for pretty low-paid work. And these contracts are won by very large companies. I'm sure many of your listeners don't know about KBR. KBR is one of the prime contractors of the government on these overseas government contracts for U.S. military bases and other facilities overseas. So they win the contract. But rather than hire these individuals directly and hire, for example, persons here in the United States, they subcontract out that responsibility to subcontractors. Our reporting found that most of them were kind of middle-sized companies based in Kuwait, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the like. But they didn't do the hire either. They then they subcontracted out that process to other contractors who went out to villages in India, Philippines, Nepal, Uganda, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Fiji, and in Ramesh's case, India, to recruit in the villages. And they would dupe these individuals, these people like Ramesh, into believing that they were going to get to well-paid jobs, that they were going to lead a better life. And what they ended up doing was enslaving them, effectively enslaving them. Ramesh was stuck on a U.S. military base in Iraq. And also, as you mentioned, Gary, as well, under the conditions under which he was living were, you know, appalling. Not only was he receiving, like, a paltry sum of money, he would be living in egregious living conditions. They were unsafe. They were unsanitary. He'd be working 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, no vacation. Food provided was inedible. Living space with 30 to 40 men. And actually, Ramesh was one of the lucky ones. Others had been recruited through a similar process, didn't even get jobs. They were warehoused in Iraq and held there against their will until they were able to escape. So I was wanting to give you a picture of how the process works and how the United States, this government is actually involved, and U.S.-based companies actually involved in the slave trade, in trafficking.
Recently, last year, New York University was challenged for having its campus in a Middle Eastern country built by slave labor, as mm-hmm. if no one knew. Everyone there knows. In fact, I spoke with a person who was living in Dubai who said that there are tens of thousands of slave laborers. They work outside in the worst possible conditions, and then they're driven out of the city and put into these very crowded, unsanitary conditions, given minimal to eat, and their passports are taken so they cannot leave. And the amount of deaths from unsafe working conditions is astronomical, but they have no representation, and everyone knows about it. Now, I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking, there's Dubai, a completely failed state. In fact, it went bankrupt, and the emir of the Emirates had to take it over from his cousin because there's no oil in Dubai, and it's sinking because it's built at sea level and the seas are rising and all those fan island homes are cracking. And the big skyscraper, the largest building in the world, the foundations are all on sand, not rock. And it's pretty much a ghost town now, though it was supposed to have been the Wall Street of the Middle East and was for a period of time. But it's had its day. So now, here you have a man who's telling me that a lot of people are getting out of there because if you don't pay your bills in Dubai, no matter who you are, you go to jail. And he said the parking lots at the airport are filled with expensive designer cars with license plates taken off because people just got out of the country. He said, but think of all the people left in the country who can't leave, don't have any money, and die. And also he said that the whole thing was such a scam, such a scheme where everybody made money that they didn't even realize they couldn't have proper sanitation, so thousands of truckloads of human waste are carted off starting in the morning out to the desert because of not being able to put in a proper sanitation system in the city itself because it's all on sand. In any case, I'm thinking Dubai has about $1 trillion of value as far as what was invested. It wouldn't have cost these contractors, the government, that much more money to have given these people a living wage and provided them with some good sanitation, good food, and good living conditions. It was a relatively minor, tiny amount of money. So you're thinking, what is it in someone's mind when you're dealing in hundreds of billions of dollars in construction contracts total, and you're cheating people and giving them $100 a month for working in 120-degree heat and no air conditioning where they're living, and giving them terrible food? What goes on in someone's mind? And yet all the American diplomats knew about it. Everyone in Dubai knew this. This was no secret. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, you hit on a good point there, and it's the effects of the system. It's the fraud and waste, not only the violations of human rights, the enslavement of these men. But when you have U.S. government contractors involved, and I'm not saying that U.S. government contractors were involved in Dubai. That wasn't the scope of our reporting. But here's how it works in the U.S. government overseas contracting process. It wastes tens of millions of dollars of U.S. tax dollars. So U.S. government contracts, you know, that KBR win to provide services overseas on U.S. military bases to the Department of State and the construction of consulates or embassies overseas. These government contracts, they'll allocate, you know, more than $1,500 per month for migrant workers. So it's $1,500 a month. And what our investigation uncovered was that contractors, so the subcontractors who these U.S.-based companies recruit to get their employees, they'll pay these migrant workers, they'll pay them $150 to $500 per month, a pittance. So you know where all that money's going. It's going into the subcontractor's pocket and it's going into the prime contractor. I mean, the whole supply chain is all about making big bucks for U.S.-based companies in overseas government contracting process with little or no concern for the plight of the employees and the conditions of the employees.
Well, Stephen, recently we had an attorney on the program who is handling a large lawsuit against Disney, Inc., for firing hundreds of American employees and then filing for jobs with cheaper foreign workers coming on H-1B visas. And Hillary Clinton, when she was heading the State Department, not only supported H-1B outsourcing of foreign workers, but had also cleaned up some consultants, such as in India, of American workers and replace them with foreign workers for much lower salaries and no benefits. And this is not, this is not ethical. This is, in my opinion, is this not the same as labor trafficking that you're dealing with? But it does touch upon serious flaws in our visa laws. So please describe how current visa rules enable diplomats in the United States State Department to benefit from labor trafficking and also provide some clear examples about how this process works.
Okay, so this is another group of individuals that I have looked at over the years that have been subjected to trafficking here in the United States. And it's migrant women workers, thousands of domestic workers in this country. But among the most vulnerable populations we found for a variety of reasons are workers who are employed by diplomats, foreign diplomats who come into, who are working here in the United States, mostly in the D.C. metropolitan, around the D.C. metropolitan area, Virginia and the likes. And the U.S. Visa process for diplomats allows these diplomats to bring into the country domestic workers. They're domestic workers. So if you're a diplomat from Kuwait and you are assigned a post in D.C. at the Kuwaiti embassy in D.C., there's a process by which you can bring your domestic worker who's been working for you out in Kuwait into the country. And the reason for that is to facilitate their performance of their functions. So there is a reason behind it. But what we discovered was happening and has been happening not just in the cases that we examined and the litigation, a case that we took against the government of Kuwait and Kuwaiti diplomat. But this is happening repeatedly. Is they're using these duplicitous diplomats are using the visa process to bring their domestic workers into the country, saying that they're going to pay them, you know, federal minimum wage, which for some of these women is significantly more than they would be getting back in Kuwait or wherever they were working for their diplomat. So they're enticed into the country under the pretense that they're going to be, the diplomat is going to pay them a significantly higher wage, when in actual fact they're brought in here, they're paid a pittance, they have their passports taken from them, and they're held as virtual slaves in their in the diplomat's home. So I'll give you another concrete example, and again it's from a case, the case I mentioned against the Kuwaiti diplomats and the state of Kuwait. It was three South Asian women were domestic workers for this diplomat and his wife. They trafficked the three of them into the country. They said that they were going to pay them a significant wage for them, and also to provide them benefits. And they also said, you know, eventually you might, you know, they said you eventually might be able to get residence here in the United States. But in actual fact, they were taken into the country. They were trafficked into the country. They were held captive in the home. They had their passports taken from them. They were, and some of them were physically and all of them emotionally abused. And they were held that way for, you know, down in the D.C. area for a year and a half before a very kind neighbor helped them escape and brought them to a direct services NGO, down there that works with trafficking victims, domestic workers, women domestic workers. And we then helped facilitate them getting trafficking visas, so temporary visas to be in the country. But that's how the U.S. government visa process is actually facilitating. There's ways and means by which the government can be policing that better. There could be greater oversight. And then when incidents like this happen, when trafficking and slavery happen here in the United States, then the authorities should be prosecuting that, and they have the tools to do that. But there isn't, in many cases, the political will to do it. That's the problem.
Final question. One of the largest areas of slavery today is in sexual slavery, and it's huge. We're talking about millions and millions of people, mainly women. Is there any evidence that this process is also contributing to sex trafficking? And are any of these firms receiving U.S. tax dollar contracts known to be engaged in the sex trade? I don't know. I'm just asking you as a point of reference.
From our reporting, no, we do, you know, our that report, we looked at the overseas government contracting process that was in place from 2000 through until the date of our report, which was June of 2012. And most of the third country nationals, they're called the migrant workers, most of them, if not all of them, were men. But we did hear of reports. There have been some reports of women being trafficked through this process, and then women are subjected, you know, they're even more vulnerable, and they are vulnerable to sexual abuse. But we didn't find anyone that had been trafficked for sexual purposes.
Okay.
More right. that they were abused because of their gender.
All right. Stephen, in our next program, we're going to be mentioning seven household names making a killing off the prison industrial complex. And these companies are paying people, inmates, 74 cents a day. Whole Foods, the costly organic supermarket, often called Whole Paycheck, purchases product made, prepared by inmates who work for private companies, and these inmates are paid 74 cents a day. And then that product, like for tilapia, is sold for $11.99 a pound. And McDonald's, the world's most successful fast food franchise, purchases a lot of goods manufactured by prison. And then Walmart, although their company policy clearly states that, quote, forced or prison labor will not be tolerated by Walmart, basically every item in their store has been supplied by third-party prison labor factories, so they lie. And then Victoria's Secrets, female inmates in South Carolina sew undergarments and casual wear for the pricey lingerie company. And then Aramark, this company also provides food to colleges and public schools and hospitals. So for all the college students and teachers and professors listening right now, understand Aramark has a monopoly on food service in about 600 prisons in the United States. Despite this, Aramark has a history of poor food service, including massive food shortages that caused a prison riot in Kentucky. Also, AT&T and is one, and also BP, British Petroleum. They spilled 4.2 million barrels of oil on the Gulf Coast, and the company sent a workforce of almost exclusively African-American inmates to clean up the toxic spill, while community members, many of whom were out-of-work fishermen, struggled to make ends meet. They weren't hired. Then also there are others. For even more detailed lists, we'll get into it, like Unicor and Nike, Nintendo, Honda, Pfizer, Saks Fifth Avenue, JCPenney, Macy's, Starbucks, Microsoft. And these are all very powerful, wealthy companies. These are people that could include a living wage and still make a profit. And that's what bothers me. So these people also should be challenged on a form, in my personal opinion, of engaging in or supporting or facilitating or enabling what I would call modern-day slavery. So that is coming up on new shows. So, Professor James Brewer Stewart, thank you very much for being with us. And also from the American Civil Liberties Union, Stephen Watt, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Gary. I look forward to your next show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Good. And for all of you listening, thank you. And we look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.
What they do.